Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. Well, we're on another holiday weekend, which, as I said before, people always say, don't do a show on holiday or holiday weekend, because everyone's going to be out doing something else as opposed to listening to the show. Well, we happen to fall on those dates, so the show must go on. Today, we have a Dr. Victoria Young. She is really a pioneer in the advocacy for saving public schools, making public schools better. She has been involved in some very important, major organizations that dedicated to saving public schools. She is an author, and we're going to talk about her book today. And why don't I just go straight to her, because we have so much to cover. Vicki, welcome to the War Report.
Well, thank you, James. I'm glad to be here.
Or I should say, Dr. Young, welcome to the War Report.
Oh, I go by many names, so that's just fine.
Give us a short bio on Dr. Young.
Well, I've been a private practitioner for 31 years, but prior to that, I did studies in human behavior as a waitress and a bartender.
Now, even I didn't know that part.
Yeah, not very many people. Well,
study
and actually,
in human behavior.
So I thought I'd throw that in there. That was very valuable lessons.
You got me, too. Why don't you say that you've been a practitioner for 31 years in veterinary
medicine.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why the human behavior part comes in, and it really got me. Oh, and where'd you go to school, and where are you from?
I'm from Albion, Michigan, and I went to school at Michigan State University is where I graduated from. And then I was waitressing and bartending my way to college at Winn-Schuler's, which is pretty well known in Michigan.
I wanted her to get that in because this is another person from Michigan.
Yep.
I didn't know that until she and I had a conversation, and we both realized that we were from Michigan. I almost went to her alma mater. And that was a long story, but anyway, we have a lot in common, and that's why I'm calling her Vicki, because we sort of like know each other, and we talk this way, and all. So forgive us if we do our little personal thing here, because we're both so thrilled that we're from Michigan, we've got a long history, and the whole nine yards. Now, what I want to do today is I want our guest to take us back to the early days of probably somewhere in the 1990s. She's a parent. She's getting involved with her school, her son's school. I don't know if you just moved to Idaho or not, but let's start from there, because it's the experiences that you had when your children were starting to school and you being so involved throughout the entire, I guess I'm going to say K through 12, that led to the book, the journey that you went through, and that's what I think people would really love to hear, and it'll provide the context for the things that we're going to, the issues that we're going to talk about.
Right, absolutely, because, you know, it's the perspective, and we are all going to come at education and education reform from different perspectives. So I moved here to Idaho in 1990. My son would have been in preschool and then started school the next year. And, you know, I went there to classrooms to help, which I did. And I will say that my teachers were wonderful. I did a variety of things, you know, anywhere from helping teach kids to read, you know, to actual bookkeeping things, whatever they wanted me to do. And along the way, you know, there were some things that really bothered me. Some of it had to do with actual curriculum and instruction. It just didn't seem right for some of the kids, and that was worrisome. And you could see by second grade what I was seeing, because I was seeing the same kids from year to year, is I felt like I was seeing a significant percentage of them that really were falling through the cracks. And, you know, that became my concern about the academics. But then there came a time in third grade, and this is kind of where the book begins, with safe and disciplined school issues. And it got to the point where there was such disruption, and there had been disruptive kids all along, but this was pretty extreme to the point where I had actually asked the teacher, would you mind if I went over your head on this one? And her response was, please do. So the safe school issues, I think, is what really, you know, sucked me into the whole fight. And it really was a fight, and I didn't feel like it needed to be. There were certainly policies in place that were being ignored. So throughout that, you know, what I ended up being most concerned about was the lack of accountability of administration. You know, they were pushing problems off rather than actually addressing them. And, of course, nobody likes to hear that. and also there was no, you know, I went through the steps that they tell you you should do with a complaint. You know, I did all the things they told me to do, including going to the school board. And by the time I got to going to the school board, you know, there were 35, 40 people in the room, you know, to support me on these issues.
Vicki, let me stop you for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
People remember she's talking about, you're not in an urban setting. You're in a small state that I don't know how many people have even visited the state. It's not an urban area per se, so we're not talking about, but people probably have the image of being at a large metropolitan area like a Chicago, like a New York or Detroit, etc., where you have a lot of, quote, poor minority kids. You're not talking about that population. You're not talking about that environment.
Well, not exactly that environment, but we have 80% free and reduced lunch. We are a Hispanic majority school by the time we get to high school. So we have some of the same demographics that they see with the larger urban areas. You know, the school
back in the 90s?
Yes.
Back
uh-huh.
in the 90s?
Uh-huh.
Hmm.
Yeah, because
I'd have lost
the
farm on that one. I would have lost the farm on that one.
Yeah.
My image of your state, I totally would have lost the farm on that one.
Well, it depends on where you are in the state. And that's what makes Idaho a little bit unique. In a lot of your other states, your largest cities are the ones that are having the most difficulty, where it's the opposite in Idaho. Our largest population areas actually have higher quality schools. So that's just the opposite of what you would see. So we're only about, you know, I say that, but we're really only about 40 minutes outside of Boise. It's kind of a valley that, you know, one location kind of blends into the next. We would be, probably at this point, maybe the fourth largest district in the state. So we're not small, comparatively. Well, we're not huge, that's for sure. But our demographics are the ones that, you know, the type of school that they say they want to help the most. And that's where I ended up, you know, delving more into the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, because it was focused on children from low-income families. And this is a low-income area, or high poverty.
Okay. So back to where you were.
Yes. So, yeah, I was back to how I got involved. And so, you know, I went, you know, jumped through the hoops, I guess you would say, ended up, you know, doing the school board thing. And what I found there was that they really weren't providing, you know, any kind of check and balance. They weren't really representing a parental perspective. I was getting more the feedback that this is what we're required to do, you know, the top-down mandate. Is, you know, these are the laws and we have to follow them, regardless of what you're telling us. So that was a bit frustrating. And then, you know, as time went by, you know, we did see the group that we had that were working on safe school issues, and also another demographic I should probably throw in, that on a per capita basis at the time, Idaho ranked, I think, fifth in gang population. So, you know, we were dealing with gangs, only when I first came here, they were actually just trying to ignore it. But I will say they have done a great job since the 90s in improving the climate that way. But so it was the attitude of the public, I think, that maybe bothered me the most of anything. You know, they didn't seem to be able to stick to the issue of safe and disciplined schools to actually solve a problem. And then along the way, if you want me to keep going here, what I noticed happened is we were sold early on the outcome-based theory of education. So we were very focused on test scores for reading and math. And that was pre-No Child Left Behind. And then when No Child Left Behind hit, it got even worse. And, you know, that kind of brings...
Before that, you discovered the whole notion of accountability comes in the 1990s, uh-huh, leading up to No Child Left Behind. You discovered the lack of accountability on the part of administration, the school board, the State Department of Education. You do a campaign takes you all the way up to the legislature, where you're going to present your argument. Those are the steps that I think, in reading your book, were the major salient event that helped shape your perspective and set you on the what now is more like something like 25-year campaign as an education activist.
Right. And going to, you know, testify to the legislature, I mean, it never made any sense. I was in the schools, and what I was seeing were children that were not going to be helped by setting higher standards and giving them more tests. And having taken a high-stakes test, you know, the veterinary examination at the end of all that time and effort, but I knew when I took the exam that it was on me. I had been given every opportunity along the way with great instruction, great facilities, you know, a curriculum that took you through and gave you what you needed to know. And it was going to be on me, but that isn't what I was seeing in my schools. At that time, you know, and this is kind of the thing that people don't realize when we talk about resources. At the time, we didn't have air conditioning in all of our schools. And if you want to see a pathetic situation, you look at kids in the afternoon with the sun beating through the windows, and they're sweaty and they're sleepy, and we're asking them to do more. It didn't make any sense. It never did. So, you know, that's what prompted me to continue, is really what we were doing to the kids.
So you are compiling a set of experiences, and the first thing that I discovered, I think, in when I was going through your book was, and you just said it, the lack of public awareness, thus the lack of public involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, and I'm now jumping the gun by several chapters here, but that is the most salient part of your journey, your experience, that I think set the tone for everything else that followed through the 90s, the 2000s, the writing of the book. Mm-hmm. Now, I said I'm jumping a gun because I wanted to sort of like save that to the end, but give me a hint. Am I anywhere close?
Oh.
Lack of, you call it
passive. Oh, yeah,
passive,
you are
passive,
definitely
I
close.
Call it, you call it passive, and I call it apathy. I'm a little bit more aggressive, and I
well,
define the public as having their heads shoved so far up. Okay.
Yes. And you know, and I do give people leeway. I mean, I understand, you know, again, it goes back to perspective. And also this idea that people don't know what's going on. And again, you can kind of look at statistics. That it makes sense. And this has always been a problem. It's been a continuing problem to keep the public involved. But when you only have, you know, like 23% of the population that has children in schools, and then you only have, well, we always laughed at school, you know, because it would only be like five of us that were actually there, you know, volunteering. So you have a very small percentage that are actually in the room to see what is happening. So what they get is what they're told in the paper and what they're told, you know, in the news and you know, is basically comes down to test scores. You know, we've been sold on this idea that test scores mean way more than they do. But yes, yeah, certainly public apathy for whatever reason is a big, big part of the problem. We are the problem. But that means we can become the solution.
Now, that's interesting because, again, I'm jumping my gun in that, but I couldn't let this go by. We are the problem. The public has never, as far as I know, and I've been at this as long as you and longer, has never stepped up and said, we are the problem. What I call, and I'm writing something now on the blame game through the years, how, and I've talked about this on the show, especially in the early months of the show, that public education has always been the white hat guys. There was a problem in the larger society. They dumped it off on public education to come up with a solution. We were white hats for the longest of time until Sputnik. Once Sputnik went up, our hat started to go from white to gray and eventually to where the black hat is now. That's a segment of the population as blaming us, but the larger population itself, oh, then of course there are parents who blame teachers and teachers who blame parents, but no one has really come out and just laid it on the line like you did in terms of it's the public, folks. We are largely, I mean, this is the message, and again, I am so jumping myself here.
That's
this,
okay.
To me, was the message of your book. From chapter to chapter to chapter, you found a way to say public, the things that are going on, the things that have been going on, much our fault as anyone else, because we have the power to bring about change. And I'm going to stop because I just said a whole lot, and I didn't intend to do this. So let me go back and stop interrupting you.
Oh, no, that's okay. I would rather we just go with the flow here.
Let me just stop here. No, we have a caller.
All right.
And so let's bring our caller in. Are you there, caller? Well,
yes.
He was
there. I'm here.
Hello? Hi. And you are?
Stephen Stalmack.
Okay. And where are you calling from, Stephen?
Prescott, Arizona.
Oh, okay. And you have a question for us?
Not at this point. I was just listening.
Okay, let's hear them.
Okay.
No, I don't have a question at this point. I was just listening. I don't want to change the subject.
Oh, okay. So you're comfortable with just listening for
that? I'll wait till later in the call. I just called in to join the conversation. That's all.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
right,
so we were.
Go, Vicki.
So you were pointing out that, you know, I do point out the public as the problem, you know, the major problem. But there certainly are a lot of contributing factors. And, you know, we can't get away from what your show is all about, you know, the fact that we are witnessing, you know, this market-based theory take over the whole works. So even though the public and their apathy or whatever you want to call it, you know, is a major contributing factor to allowing this to happen, the fact is that it opened the door. You know, it opened the door for a takeover of the public system. And, you know, I think we, you know, we don't want to get away from that because right now that is the battle. Unfortunately, we have a lot of little battles that we have to, you know, address, and those are always going to be issues that are on the ground in the schools. But right now, this overwhelming problem, you know, is that we are being mandated things from the top down that we shouldn't be. So that is, you know, kind of how I, you know, I came to that conclusion eventually. Through all my trials and tribulations. And in the process, you know, I did write some things to keep myself on track because I felt like at times that I was chasing my tail. I mean, anybody that's been involved with trying to solve a problem, unless they've been extremely lucky, you know, because I always thought, well, maybe it's just my district. And there are going to be variations in the districts. But, you know, anybody in a district that's not real receptive to improvement or doesn't have the capacity to improve themselves, you're going to find resistance, and they're going to send you on, you know, your little jaunt. And so, you know, my jaunt went from my district to the legislature to the State Department to the U.S. Department of Education and right on back around again. Everybody was passing the buck. And that is the problem is they made, you know, and No Child Left Behind is the typical example. They made the law, and then who actually is accountable? And that was my question that I kept seeking an answer to, is, and what they would do is point to the next level up until it got to the U.S. Department of Education, and then it would come back down to the local board. And we keep going in this circle. And that's why I wrote a formula to keep myself on track. And that is one of the things, because that kind of, you know, brings us up to this idea that we have the answers. And that's what I really, really, truly believe is, and that's why it's called the Crucial Voice of the People. Throughout it, I actually have local, you know, I actually have people, regular people, that have the answers. And one day I'll never forget, I was in practice, and a lady came in with a dog, a young girl, and she says, you know, we get all done, and she starts talking about her work. And she had no idea what I do on the side. And I said, oh, what do you do? And she said, well, I'm a first-year kindergarten teacher. And I said, oh, really? I said, well, how did it go this year? And she says, you know, she says, I can't believe I had to write a grant in order to get pencils and crayons to put in the hands of these kids that are coming in and had never, you know, had experience with using crayons and pencils. And this is in even a more rural area outside of the district I'm in. But she was absolutely right. Why do you have to write a grant for something that is essential to teaching that group of kids? And that's exactly what they were trying to point out with the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, is that we do, you know, resources are important.
You make a point when you introduce the origins of the war on poverty, starting with Johnson's war on poverty, and how and why this act was formulated. Talk about that, because a lot of people, they only are in the here and now.
Uh-huh.
And they don't realize that the issues that are the here and now, they've been around for decades, and I even go back to 100 years plus. We just see them mm-hmm. being recycled, renamed, maybe different emphasis, but basically the same thing. And then I think it was in Chapter 4, when you say, here comes No Child Left Behind, you say to the reader, you got to remember that Lyndon Dean Johnson and his war on poverty, that's when this bill came through, and it had a particular purpose. Tell us that purpose.
Right. And one thing I will say, though, to clarify that a little bit, the war on poverty, and Johnson knew that one single thing wasn't going to solve it, but that there were several pieces, and education was one of the pieces. And again, you got to kind of put it in historical perspective. This was around the same time, even though we had legally desegregated schools, we were still fighting that fight. So the real fight for ESEA was kind of a dual thing. It was to offer equal educational opportunity and address it by focusing federal funding on disadvantaged children. And that's where, you know, we really get off course, is when people look at what we've got with No Child Left Behind, we've gone way off base. And it happened in a series of things. And most people don't know who Marshall Mike Smith is, but anyway, he was pretty instrumental in making some changes to the laws in 1978 and again in 1994. The one took the funding from a focus on the children to a focus on whole schools. And we were actually warned not to do that, you know, that would result in us kind of taking our eye off the ball. And it actually, it took our eye off the children and put it more on assessing whole schools. And then by 1994, that assessment of whole schools was based on standards, you know, and off we went on that jaunt. So we really were taken off base totally. And I would, if there was anything I could urge people to do, it's to try and understand what Title I was meant to be. So the funding was, you know, focused on children, which meant that on the ground, in the classroom, in the districts, we needed to know what do those children, the disadvantaged children, what do they need in order to learn? And so that's where a needs assessment comes in. And now if you look at Title I, the latest version, that's just like passing in the night. It means nothing. But if you aren't actually addressing funding to needs, you're missing the boat. I hope that makes
you're not
sense.
Taking in the whole child. You're not taking in the notion of community schools that are kind of surfacing now as a potential answer, when it was basically part of this potential solution back in the 60s, the what goes around comes around sort of thing.
Right.
That,
but
I would totally agree there.
Community schools, though, that's a term that has been also corrupted, I guess you would say, over time. The original community education concept, you know, was, again, that communities would come together to solve their own problems, which included schools, and schools, in turn, were going to be used to solve community problems. It was a partnership. It's not about actually saying, like they do in the law right now, that these schools are going to have wraparound services. What the old law was saying was, if you identify children's needs, then those are the services you need to deliver. And I know it sounds maybe like it's a semantics, but it really isn't. it's really about not so much a bureaucracy as a public service. So it's kind of a different type of concept. And now community schools, again, that name has been co-opted. It's turned into, I understand, I think it's in Ohio, that a lot of the charter schools have taken the name community schools. And so people, you know, are starting to associate community schools as charter schools, but they really aren't. I don't see how the community schools of a charter are the same thing at all. I mean, they actually are almost the opposite. They're, they have a pretty exclusive group, and that was totally not what the community education concept was about. So the terminology gets really hard.
And in the book, you talk about the arrival of No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
And what its intent was, and how it, I guess, is being played out today following its own intent. One of the things that struck me in that chapter was that in the 90s, it was individual accountability at the student level. Because you were very, very, very concerned about the exit exam. Students can graduate from their senior year if they didn't pass the exit exam. And your argument was, how can you, one, make everyone take this exam, giving them a 3-year window of developing the exam, verifying its validity, and then using it. And the stakes then, the high stakes was, if you don't pass this exam, you don't get a diploma. You thought that was totally unfair. But No Child Left Behind, my note here is there was a major shift from individual to the larger, the school, the teacher, administration, and indirectly the condemnation of the family and the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a total misuse and unethical use of standardized tests. And I think that's where sometimes in this war, and it's a kind of a war of words, you know, it's, if you're against this, then you high stakes testing, as if you're against all standardized testing. And that's just simply not true. But what I am for is the proper use of the test. And to use the test properly, people have to understand, just like in veterinary medicine, you have to understand the potential downfalls of any test. How can it be interpreted or misinterpreted? When do you get a false negative versus, you know, a false positive? All of those things, all those little things go into it. And one of the most frustrating things that I saw with the No Child Left Behind, the outcome-based theory, is that this false assumption that higher test scores mean better education. It just is absolutely not true. And in the end, what it did here in my community was what little science they had or what little social studies they had just disappeared from the curriculum. You know, I think when a parent like myself walks in and asks, do you have a science curriculum? Then I think that's it should have been a huge red flag. And I don't think people that are in districts that have more resources, that have a broader curriculum, I don't think they understand when we say that No Child Left Behind and Common Core now narrows the curriculum. It's narrowing the curriculum to math and language arts. For low-income children, that's devastating because in school, they used to have, if they had a broad curriculum, that's where they were having opportunities to learn in different fields, exposure to different things. And they're the kids least likely, you know, to be going on a family trip with their, you know, and those going to parks, going to other places. They just do not have the resources to do that. I thought it was just the opposite of what the kids in my community needed. The kids in my, I had a, one of my daughter's friends, I think it was her 16th birthday, was over here, and he started talking about how he'd never been in a forest. You know, and I thought, what? And that's, you know, you only have to go 5 miles. And then, you know, I had a chemistry teacher tell me, that, and this was in a community college here, that she had a girl in her class who had never boiled water. Community college level. Never boiled water. So, you, I mean, those are the kind of experiences, that's the narrowing of the curriculum, you know, that we hear said, but for some reason we're able to ignore that and move on with another set of standards and another set of tests to identify the same schools we identified before. And that's where I say it has to stop, because we've identified them.
You bring me back to, I guess, the last part of my idea of our conversation, and that is back to the title of your book, The Crucial Voice of the People. The missing ingredient.
Yep.
Two things. You've given us a hint of the path and somewhat of the, say, mostly in the path. That's what got you involved, because your voice wasn't being heard. But there were probably millions of, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of parents who, or concerned citizens who were attempting to have their voices heard. Compare that when you started writing a book, and this is something that I worked on. I'm on the road, folks. I'm not at home, about 60 miles from home. And on my trip here, I kept saying, when she wrote this book, the book was published 2013, probably meant that the actual writing took her up. Maybe around 2012, possibly part of 2011. The apathy was still very much in evidence, although there were groups that United Opt Out and et cetera. Did you, when you were writing this book, envision the phenomena that took place in New York over the past 30 to 40 days? And I know you know what I'm talking about in terms of the Opt Out New York, and then just last week in Long Island, part of New York City, they pulled off a coup where they elected 50-some-odd people out of a field of, positions of 70-something on their slate. Now, that is public awareness, public understanding, and public activism, but not on a level that you probably envision, and I'm guessing now, back as far as 2011, possibly 2012. Am I anywhere close?
Well,
on that point.
Well, I think what you need to understand is that I have hope. And I think I always hoped that this is what we were going to see, an uprising. You know, nobody could predict what that uprising was going to be about, what it was going to look like. And so, you know, I can't say that I envisioned that. I would say I dreamed about it. I mean,
Was this what you were calling for?
Absolutely what I'm calling for. You know, but it's what the really, really difficult part about it is knowing that people can easily rise up against something, and it's really harder for them to rise up for something, especially when the information has been so skewed. You know, we really haven't heard the truth about our schools. Because I hear, you know, I was criticized early on for talking about schools, And I, you'll notice I tried to always use the word failed schools in parentheses, you know, or in quotation marks, because that wouldn't have been my choice of words. What I experienced was dysfunctional schools. Actually, what I'd like to hear, I heard this recently somewhere, troubled schools. We have identified troubled schools. They are schools in trouble, and we need to help them. And I think that's probably the best terminology I've heard so far. And so I'd like to hear us talk about those schools and what the actual problems are and how we can help them. But that is what Title I.
When you say we, who's the we that you're talking about?
The we is more than just the parents that you're seeing. The parents, definitely. The school teachers, definitely. We have some administration rising up, but unfortunately, a lot of our leadership has actually been educated with the outcome-based philosophy, the standards testing accountability mechanism. And I don't think that we've gotten enough information out. We haven't gotten the truth out to them, not enough of them, to make a difference with the law. And then, of course, our lawmakers do not seem to understand the concepts very well at all. So they're not changing the law to fit what the country needs. So if we could have a come-to-Jesus moment with them, that would be fantastic. But, you know, having studied some of those people, this is their philosophy. This is their plan. And it's going to be pretty difficult to change, you know, their mindset.
So that brings me back to the public, the parents, what I refer to as the IT community, that being the teachers, the administrators, the parents, and then the students themselves, and then the larger public that has a concern about public education and its well-being. That's a huge population, potentially. That's an enormous population. Is this the population that you are dedicating your book to when you say the crucial voice of the people, the missing ingredient?
Uh-huh. I am. And actually, the title of the book, you know, first it was Education's Missing Ingredient, What Parents Can Tell Educators. Now, that title, that wasn't the title, that's the title my publisher picked. I actually wrote that under the title Just a Parent, because that's really how I felt in the system, is that I was just a parent. And when you say that, you know, these were the frustrations I went through, I would never have written a book if it was just me, because I can kind of like, I can deal with it if people are not nice to me or things don't go well for me. I can deal with that. But I kept hearing parent after parent after parent, you know, telling me the exact same things that I was feeling, thinking. You know, they were reaffirming what I thought, what my perception was. And I was in the grocery store one day, and a lady stopped me, and she started telling me all these things. And I was sitting in my mind going, yep, I've got that in chapter 2, that one's in chapter 4, that one's, you know, and I told my publisher that story. And that's where he came up with the subtitle, What Parents Can Tell Educators. Okay, so it isn't just my voice. But then by the time I got to writing the second edition, I did want to call it the crucial, I wanted to call it the voice of the people, but I needed a descriptor, I thought. And I was reading something that Deb Meyer had written. And she was talking about decision-making processes because she was a principal. She knows how, you know, difficult that job can be, and making decisions, trying to take everybody's ideas into consideration. Eventually, your administrator has to make a call, just like your school board does. But she said, what we can't do is exclude the crucial voice of the local people. And she nailed it. You know, and that's actually how the title came about. So anyway, not just my voice, but the voice of many, many. And then there's all of the professional educators that have been through the same type of thing, you know, different perspective, but still been ignored along the way. And I feel their pain. Believe me, I feel their pain. And so that was the reason for writing. It is meant to be easy enough to read for parents and the general public, but yet there's information in there that, that educators, you know, the historic research that I did, I think is something that, that needs to come forward in schools of education, because we've lost so much of that history that we've drifted. We've just drifted off the intent of the law, you know, to address the needs of children of low-income families. So anyway, that and communities, you know, because it is this community concept idea. And just like people are, you know, I've read several people recently that have said it's the concentration of poverty in these communities that makes it so difficult to overcome in the schools. And that was the research, and that goes back to the research of Ronald Edmonds, where he looked at the demographics of schools that were high poverty, at that time high minority, but they were high achieving. And he looked at the characteristics of those schools. And in my mind and in my research, those schools were community schools. And it was during the time period when we were actually narrowing the achievement gap. And that is the premise of that book. And the slant on the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is that, you know, this is all one and the same. But we've drifted away from it in favor of standards and testing.
Since we are now coming close to our time to exit, let me see if I can offer my summary and then let you have the last word on this. And I'm reading your book over the last couple of weeks. I know something about you. We've talked. I read some of your other work, and so I got a picture here of the person. And that's what I try and do on the show, is have a conversation with the person. And in the process of doing that, we talk about the book, we talk about research, we talk about the experience, etc. But all of those are parts of talking about the person. So using my own personal approach, I'm looking at the book and all the stuff that I know about you, and I'm saying, in a very mild way, as I said earlier, you're saying, public, let's keep the word public in our public schools. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we, the public, be it the ed community portion of the general population, have to become more active in how everyone wants to define being an activist. Because if mm-hmm. we don't, things that have happened in the past, things that are happening now, will continue unabated. And we're going to wake up one morning and we're going to have a school system that is no longer, quote, a public school system in the traditional sense, but a variant of that. And I'm speaking in your voice now, I'm laying the challenge back to the public. I, almost every page, every chapter, I kept saying to myself, she is calling out the public. And then I compared that what happened in New York as the public answering your call. That was fascinating for me. And again, I'm on my way up here, right? I'm in the traffic, the whole 9 yards. I'm going, they heard her. And this is what can happen when the public listens to Victoria Young and the rest of us who have been calling this out for so long. And I have a note here, and I said, Vicky has to be ecstatic over what has happened in the last 4 or 5 weeks. Now, it took them 3 years to get to that point, because they were under some of the people from that coalition in New York. And it didn't happen overnight. But they showed for the rest of the country, this is what can happen when the public, it was the parents, but they're part of the public, became aware, understood, got organized, and start to kick ass.
Yep. But I will say I would wish my voice was that powerful. I would have changed the law by now. But you know, and again, the book is really a reflection of what I saw in people. You know, I was joking kind of when I said in the beginning, you know, that my study in human nature, you know, was as a waitress and a bartender. But, you know, regardless, people can be frustrating, but I really, really have faith in the American people that given the facts, if they knew the truth, we will rise up and do the right thing. Now, you know, getting the truth out there is going to take some work yet. I am I'm really, really pleased about how things are going. But I have, you know, I have this target, and that target is the law. And if we don't change the elementary and secondary education back to what it used to be, the focus back where it was, we're going to be another decade with the wrong focus of the law. And the law really is powerful. I mean, think about segregation by law and desegregation by law. And certainly the power that No Child Left Behind seemed to have over all of us. And, you know, and Common Core and the whole thing, it seems to be so powerful that it's having people, adults that should know better, make kids cry over taking tests. And that's a very real thing. That happened, you know, to somebody I knew just a few weeks ago and kind of sent me on a little tirade up and down the food chain again. But it's real, and the people that make the laws are not seeing the results, the human results, the stress they put on families with the policies that they set. So even though I'm pleased with where we've come to at this point, I just see a real need for us to really give it that last good college try here.
Which brings me to my final question. What does Vicki do to push us further and over the hump?
Well, I would like to answer
besides
questions.
Besides appearing on the War Report, okay? Besides that.
Well, you know, what I'm doing right now myself is I am calling my senator's office on a regular basis. I have emailed suggestions along the way. I'm also reaching out to an organization that helps write, not clear law. They're against this idea of clear law, but it's more clean bills, you know, that we actually have an Elementary and Secondary Education Act that's readable. The original one was 35 pages. You know, so I am still continuing on the, you know, looking at the law and trying to get people to realize that there is an alternative. And, you know, okay. We just aren't even considering that. Right now, that bill has over 300 pages that address standards and assessments.
Alone, just that part alone.
Alone.
The whole thing,
the original,
900 pages, something like that.
Yeah, the original law had one paragraph about the appropriate measures that we needed to do. So we've got a ways to go. But I do urge people to call their representatives, you know, even with the message that you need to make the elementary and secondary education right. It needs to go back to its original goals. And I know they came out of, you know, their last meeting when they unanimously passed the Every Child Achieves Act, saying that it's getting back to the goals. I am sorry to disagree. It is not.
Vicki, with that, our time is up. I will add, in addition to all the things that Vicki says she is doing, she's found time to come to the War Report and hopefully stimulate all of us to become much more active, less passive, and I'm talking to people beyond the teaching core, beyond the parent core. We need the whole community, because what is going on has direct impact on what our humanity is going to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now. I won't be around, but you guys will have to deal with that. With that, let me say, have a happy holiday, Memorial Day, to all my fellow veterans. I'm a vet. This is our day, or tomorrow will be our day. And I hope you guys had a chance to listen, and we'll reflect on this as we go forward from today on. With that, I'm going to have to say good evening, and have a good holiday and a nice weekend to everyone. And you too, Vicki.
You too, James. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.